This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning. I'm going to talk about the last four lines on page two. Unfortunately, I have a lot to say, but I'll try to stop at some point. So this is called the Bodhisattva Vows, and so I'm gonna chant them first. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are endless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So there's a bit of intensity to that. Personally, vowing. These are called Bodhisattva vows, which means they developed under Mahayana Buddhism. I'm going to resist explaining Mahayana Buddhism. It was a later development in Buddhism. Maybe during Q&A, I'll say something, but I want to stick to the point, because what's very interesting to me, it took me a while to realize this, is these exactly match the Buddha's first teaching called the Four Noble Truths. But one quality of these inherent in here is they're impossible. You will never accomplish. And I'm going to refer to different translations. Some reason this verse, different Zen centers use little different translations. So some say, I vow to save them all. But this is all beings in the universe into the future. So it's impossible to save them all. So all of these have that same characteristic. Like, we're vowing to do something we can never completely accomplish. But I say these vows, they point our boat in the right direction. We'll never get to whether you believe in past lives or not. Some of the Mahayana sutras talk about having uncountable number of lives over an uncountable period of time. But this is from our heart. This is our goal. So the First Noble Truth, which I'll paraphrase, Buddha said, you know, you might want to face the fact that you're going to have some suffering in your life. Which should be pretty obvious, as our get toothaches and we stub our toes and we got emotional stuff, and then the news, oh my God, the news, and just looking at people in supermarkets, they seem to be struggling a bit. So what we want to save others for, because we care about others, is called unnecessaries. So I can give you an example, because it happened kind of recently. I was doing some carpentry and I hit my finger. Ouch, yeah. So unavoidable suffering is ouch. Avoidable suffering is, oh, what a stupid idiot I am. I'm a terrible carpenter. I wasn't being mindful. Okay, this kind of self-criticism is unnecessary. Turns out criticizing others is kind of unnecessary suffering, because Others are who they are, but they're already who they are. So we're interested in saving others from unnecessary suffering. But of course, that'd be hard to do if we don't work on saving ourselves from unnecessary suffering. When I was young, my in-laws were very into some kind of new age spirituality, channeling, being. And I was kind of critical of that. So I said to my Zen teacher, you know, yeah, they have some weird beliefs. And why don't they see that Buddhism is like the only natural thing to believe? Right. She said, are they happy with their beliefs? I said, oh, yeah, they're happy. But oh, don't bother them with it. You know, Buddhism is for people kind of struggling with suffering. He also would say, oh, he said, why are you all here? Nobody said anything. And then he goes, because you're at the end of your rope. And then he'd laugh. He didn't think being at the end of the rope was that too bad of a situation. Maybe it's a good situation. End of the rope's a phrase of, yeah, you're climbing down a rope and it ends, but maybe you're not on the ground yet. Anyhow. So most Zen centers have changed the word stay to the word free. We want to free people from unnecessary suffering. So I prefer the word free. Save, we got this Christian context, like, let me save you by asking you to believe what I believe. Or save's kind of like, sounds like I know what your problem is. Let me fix you or save you. And that seems like kind of meddling in people's lives. So I like the word I vow to free others because we say we want to be liberated from unnecessary suffering. But then sometimes I feel the word free is a little too cold. Like saves a little too warm. Free's like, okay, you're freed, fly away. Of course, everyone flies away anyhow, but like now you're liberated and let's continue to hang out. You don't know. So that's my take on the first line. The second noble truth, Buddha said, you know, there's a cause to your unnecessary suffering, which is mainly not seeing things clearly, not seeing things the way they are, and being swept away by what we call the three poisons, excessive desire. Now, desire is fine because we're mammals. We need contact, we need food, shelter, but when you get too carried away by desire, it becomes greed. We're hurting ourselves, hurting others. Hatred, well, it makes sense not to like certain things, but if we're too carried away, which we often are, we're just adding all this anguish, suffering to what's actually just a simple opinion or preference. Third one's called ignorance or delusion, is kind of a catch-all for being clueless, as we actually aren't. So I, at center I go to, this is the translation we use, but in the 70s, teacher Katagiri Roshi came from San Francisco to Minnesota, and he was using the translations I think San Francisco Zen Center was using then, and we chant it, these desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And I'm like, that's intense, because we haven't done desires. And I'd say to myself, does that mean I like can't enjoy ice cream? Does that mean I can't enjoy a stick? You know, it's like, so after the original teachers passed away, pretty much a consensus, now let's change desires to delusions. That's a little less shocking. But you know, ice cream, you eat too much ice cream every day, it's bad for you. And sex is complicated because there's two people and they both should be having a good time, and you have to like try to figure all that out. So even in good things, there's kind of some inherent confusion and suffering because things are always changing and hard to keep up. So delusions, I mean, that I say delusions is the ocean we swim in. And well, one of my teachers, Rib Anderson up in further north here, he said, enlightenment is waking up your delusion. It's becoming aware of your delusion. That's what waking up. So, however, so I say I vowed to end them. It's, like I said, impossible, but I think, oh, that'd be cool. That'd be great to. And then I say, you know, some delusions are more delusional than others. So we can at least kind of steer ourselves away from the most deluded of our delusions. So the Four Noble Truths are diagnosed, sometimes the Buddha's called the great doctor, diagnosed like, oh, I checked you out, you've got some suffering going on. And here's the cause of suffering, which kind of unfortunate, but you're through our karmic habits, our society's habits, we're kind of doing this unnecessary stuff that we can actually, and we get these all kind of flow into each other. Because the third noble truth is the good news. It's like you can suffer less. There's a way to do that. Well, that's good news. So instead of delusions, we use the word dharma is called the truth. But it's not a static truth because everything's changing. But dharma's like, well, this is the way things are. My coworker stands too close to me and he has bad breath. You know, it's like, I don't know. I just, you know, that's the way things are. It's temporary. So, at our Zen Center, I've gone with the translation, dharmas are boundless. I vow to wake up to them. But I'm thinking of switching to this translation. Dharma gates are endless. So, because everything's constantly changing, there's motion. Like, we're meeting our life as like a gate that we pass. So, we're going to get in tune with this endless change. And we're going to enter the truth as it is in this moment. And the Dharma truth is constantly changing. So we're just going to constantly engage with it and enter the gate. And then, of course, there's another gate, and we just keep engaging in life and entering the gate. So the fourth noble truth is there is a path to waking up to having less suffering. I'll talk about that path in a minute. It's called the Eightfold Path. So let me go back to this translation. So the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. Seems to me like too braggadocious, like we got the best way. Well, of course, part of me thinks we have the best way. That's why I'm doing it. But on the other hand, so I came up, and this is weird that I empowered myself at the Zen Center I lead to come up with a phrase. I said, Buddha's way is beyond compare. Well, that's kind of like unsurpassable, but it has this double message that I see is like, stop comparing. You know, that's actually where a whole lot of our suffering comes from, is comparing ourselves to others, comparing, winner, loser. So I say, Buddha's way is beyond compare. And then I got this from several other Zen centers. They say, I vow to embody it. So what I kind of don't like about becoming, like, oh, that's in the future. You know, I'm gonna, which of course we practice, we change. Hard to know how much of that's from our Zen practice and how much is just from being less clueless with maturity, although maturity doesn't mean being old doesn't guarantee. Usually. So I say embody it. So our practice is with our body. That's something we can do now, is take care of our body. So the Eightfold Path, I'll go through that. I think the order can be changed, but it generally starts with the right understanding. Now, understanding sounds kind of intellectual, philosophical, which, yeah, it's the assumptions we make about reality. So we should question how true are the assumptions we're making about reality. Can our understanding be improved? We see Dharma truth a little more clearly. And then the next one's called right intention. So intention, like these bodhisattva vows, they kind of come from our heart. It's like, well, this is my purpose. And I made up this kind of demeaning joke that a person can become an expert, they can read everything about Buddhism, be an expert on understanding it, and they could maybe still be a jerk. So intentions about not wanting to be a jerk, just intellectual understanding. And then the next four parts of the Eightfold Path have to do with our behavior. So we start with speech, being aware of our speech, being aware of its effect on others. So around speech, we often just kind of go unconscious. It's just like, let me share this thought I'm having, you know? And I learned this thought from other people, but now it seems like my thought. And we just like blurt it out and yak, yak, yak. But the Buddha said, you know, you should pay attention to your speech. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it appropriate? So that's one realm of practicing, is paying attention to our speech. The next one's pretty broad. It's called action. So what are we doing? What are we doing with our body? What are we doing? A lot of what we're doing is consuming. I'm this hopeless being environmentalist, so I'm like, oh, too much consumption. First consumption is all our bills, but yeah, just wake up to what are we doing? And then I forget the order on here, but so one of them's right, effort. So that's kind of the quality we bring to what we're doing. So we might have ideas of what's wholesome, and we might say, yeah, I'll get to that eventually. I'll fiddle around being more wholesome. But on other lists in Buddhism is all full of lists. There's one quality where they recommend called, I love this word, zeal. I don't use the word zeal too much, but it means put some energy into your actions. But on the other hand, you don't want to be frantic. You know, you don't want to be all over the place, too much energy. So Buddhism says, well, pay attention to the quality of your effort. Number six in this area called right livelihood. So, you know, we have these goals to help society be more healthy, and but we also have to make a living. So it's pretty easy to say, well, this is the company culture, this is where I can get a job. But the Buddha didn't meant to research. The Buddha said there's five prohibited professions, but I can only remember three. One's to not deal in human body, which obviously would be slavery or exploiting or gain. So that's pretty broad and has various implications. Another was to not deal in animal flesh. So you don't want to kill and sell meat, but I think different times in history, Buddhists are pretty good hypocrites like everyone else. So it's said that Buddhists like to live with Muslim people because they could have let the Muslim people be the butchers. And then this is really cheating. But then they don't have to kill. They could just like do what we do. Right? Nice feedback. But yeah, well, that's pretty intense because it implies being vegetarian. And then this one, I think it's really intense. Buddha said, do not be involved in making weapons. You know, our economy, all this money goes into making weapons. And my opinion is like, there's pressure to use these weapons so people can get paid to make more weapons. In my view, it's really sick, however. I considered if I stand outside a bomb facility with a sign that says no bombs. Protesters aren't doing that, no. So these right livelihood is pretty complex. But if we can just do a little bit, you know, as yeah, we see in our life. In the 80s, there was protests against the buildup of nuclear weapons. My teacher, Katagiri Roshi, said, well, no, we should have compassion because these workers in the bomb factories, they're just making a living. But my other huge influence on me, Thich Nhat Hanh, said, somebody asked him, oh, I got this job at the military factory. He's like, oh, you should definitely quit. Can't you like be a janitor? Can't you do something else? So, like, two sides, right? Livelihood. And the last two is what we really emphasize in Zen practice. So, one is called mindfulness. Simply, are you working on being more present, putting more of your energy to your immediate experience? And, we only have so much energy. So if we put more to immediate experience, there's less available for unnecessary suffering. So that works pretty well. The eighth one, well, we call it right samadhi. So it seems like mindfulness is enough, but I notice when I'm practicing mindfulness, it's like, here I am, and there's my object. Oh, hi, object. I'm aware of you. I'm taking care of you. I'm being mindful. Good boy. A few seconds later, I totally forgot about it, but, samadhi, sometimes I think it's mindfulness is kind of hanging out around the mouth of the cave of samadhi. Samadhi, you really merge with life. You merge with your object so that you can have this pretty neat experience of there's no you and no object. It's very peaceful. And it's very harmonious and peaceful. So we shouldn't just stop at mindfulness. We should be interested in what's really, say, dropping this concept of ourself and just really, really being. People, mindfulness has become pretty secular, and then there's this criticism of people assuming mindfulness is going to make everybody better. So it's said businesses would have, they do this more in Japan, but businesses are like, well, I'm going to teach my employees mindfulness practice because they'll be more flexible, as in malleable, maybe, or they'll happier. So maybe our profits will grow if the employees practice mindfulness. But I think, oh, good luck with that. As they're being mindful, they might be like, this job really sucks. My boss is really a jerk. I'm waking up. What's going on? So I don't worry about that too much. But on the other hand, but a realization I had re recently. So people say, I'm going to be mindful because it's going to make me better. Well, that make me better, that's not in the present moment. Make me better, make other people better. That's in the future. So, by definition, you're not practicing mindfulness when you're thinking about all the benefits of mindfulness. But of course, it's good and natural to think of the benefits. That's the samadhi. We want to just go deeper than what will I gain out of mindfulness. So, fortunately, my talk wasn't as long as I feared. So we got time. Any kind of questions or comments?
No.
I get that question, then I always look at my watch. But I have an empty watch. Yeah, it freaks people out. I have like, oh, I hate dark. So, well, Buddha said, well, there's two views that are a little bit not accurate. And one is called believing in existence. But so I define emptiness as realizing everything is not as substantial as we think. It's not denying that everything doesn't exist. Things definitely exist, but we attribute an exaggerated substantiality, which means two things. We ignore the fact that everything is changing. So emptiness means this form we've identified, this idea we've identified, it gets out of date in a couple of seconds. It exists, but it's changing almost instantly or eventually. And the other thing our substantiality ignores is nothing exists in a vacuum. Like I've identified this standalone entity, so I know reality, it's like nothing's a standalone. Everything is constantly supporting, influencing, changing each other as part of this radical impermanence. So emptiness isn't like some far out zombie state. It's kind of just the truth. And to the extent we don't inform ourselves about impermanence and interconnectedness, we take form. We should take form seriously, but we take it too seriously. Yeah, scratching your head's pretty good. You're thinking about it. I went to dinner last night with my nephew who is making the circuit boards that run AI. He's very high computer, and oh, he's going to have ChatGPT do his interior decorating for him. It's not weapons, but anyhow, he's really into it. So then I'm telling my wife, and she's like, "Doesn't he know about the environmental impact of these data centers?" And it's like, yeah, I don't know my nephew very well. We're just kind of recently getting to know each other. I'm not going to put that in his face, but I consider my behavior around it. And then my niece started at UC Berkeley, and she wants to become a nuclear physicist. And I just don't have the heart to tell her, I think uranium should have been left in the ground, like, because it's so toxic. But that's a pretty far out view. So my far out views, and even if we want to work with nuclear energy safely, some people should know about it. Like my niece is a wonderful person, so she'll figure things out. But yeah, those are huge questions for society, and to work on it with ourselves. The questions are a good thing. Answers are all questionable. Well, if you think you hurt somebody, you can apologize. So, like, right speech can, this is why we need to keep communicating endlessly, because words are not that accurate. So it's like you're trying to explain your point of view, and then you're like, oh, that was a little off on this area, so then we should talk again. Well, what I really meant is I didn't want to exaggerate that point you're misunderstanding. What I really meant is this, and it's like, oh wow, that wasn't quite right either. So speech can actually never quite hit the truth, but we have to keep like shooting for the truth the best we can. Apologizing is great for relationship. Well, I mean, apologizing, not like groveling, but it's like, I think you might have misunderstood. Yeah. And a lot of we have a prohibition against gossip. But sometimes we intentionally say things not the best way because it's just so funny. Or it's just so insightful, but it's not the always most wholesome. And delusion's pretty broad. So there's obvious lying, which sometimes seems to be a thing. But then there's a very deep delusion of, okay, there's reality. It's stuff happening outside ourselves. But for us and everybody else, we only know what's happening because it's filtered through our nervous system. So light hits the cones and retina, and our nervous system takes over from there. Sounds vibrate our eardrums. Our nervous system takes over from there. So we think we're experiencing reality out there, but what we're experiencing is our nervous system reacting to form. And boy, we have some, every nobody can agree on anything because everyone's had a different life experience. They have different preferences pre-wired in their nervous system. So that's a very broad view of delusion. Delusion is sometimes called ignorance, but teacher Katagiri Roshi, he's like, well, ignorance is pretty good because then you like ask questions. You try to get free from ignorance. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, so desire, it's a form of delusion. And it's tricky because we should, kind of putting down consumption, but of course we should consume. Of course we should eat. Of course we should see a good movie, read a good book. You know, of course we're. So there's a point that we, this is why we need to be awake to the present moment. At what point is my natural, wholesome desire starting to become unwholesome? Too much ice cream, too much disregarding other people's needs. So working with desire is like very alive, that we consider what's wholesome and what's hurting. So Buddha's final teaching was another list. And the first thing on his list, he said, have few desires. He didn't say have no desire. He said, have few desires. And the second thing on his list, similar, is be content. Be content with what you have, like the positive side of desire. So it's not black and white, it's something we be with. Do you have a question online, Harbor?
When you were talking about the Dharma gates being numberless and you're about to enter them, you said that the only thing that's true is the constancy of the change, that everything is changing, including the truth. So the Dharma gates being numberless, that means there is no ultimate truth, that everything you see or the dustness of the present moment is actually the ultimate truth that keeps changing. There is nothing. I mean, even if you see the ultimate truth, how would you know it? So I guess what my thing is that what you see is what you get is what you see, or what you see is what you get. That's the ultimate truth at any moment. Is that a valid statement?
And so, this Tibetan teacher, he said in Tibet, the word for Buddhism is the internalist, meaning they're very aware that it's their internal state. That if you're going to make any improvement, you'd like to be a little more successful with your internal state than somebody else's state. So Buddhism's kind of this radical subjectivity. And there's this, we have a teacher from 12th century Japan, Dogen, and he writes pretty complicated stuff because he's talking about everything separate, everything's not separate, everything's separate, everything's not separate. And it gives you a headache. But I was talking to him and this teacher who was presenting it, and I said, I've been studying this 50 years. I feel like I understand it. And when I feel like I, and let's use the word awakening instead of enlightenment. And like, I feel like I'm kind of awake, but you know, that can't be right. And he's like, you know, I said, am I just imagining I'm awake? He said, yeah, you're imagining you're awake, but then he said, everything's awake. There is, doesn't mean things don't exist, but like I said, through our nervous system, our senses get triggered, and then our already existing nervous system kicks in to interpret it, and our interpretations that's a magic. There you are. I'm relying on you for the time. More questions? Oh, friend of mine's a bird watcher. So number one thought in his mind is, what bird is that? You know, and then he identifies the bird. He can think, oh yeah, that bird, it lives here, lives there, it does this, it does that. It's in danger. It's not. He can have all these thoughts about that bird, but he was sitting outside meditating like he likes to do. And a bird came flying by and he just experienced it. He just could see it. He could, actually, it flew so close he felt it. So that was kind of a wake up experience for him. So he realized he didn't have to know intellectually all about that bird. He just like can experience like, wow, that was, I was really one with that experience. So you look at a tree, you know, you can, ideally you're like, well, that's a pretty neat tree, but you could be, I don't know, I saw a branch on the path kind of hanging out. I thought, you know, maybe I should get some slippers. It's hanging out too far. So instead of like just seeing things that we have to identify and manipulate, like, well, you know, let's just appreciate the immediate wonder of anything. Pardon? So everything is a part of. Mm-hmm. So it occurred to me, well, I got this side of me that thinks I'm fantastic and this side of me that thinks I'm terrible. So I realized there's a difference. We should have confidence. And okay, here I go talking about the benefit of meditation. Energy. You sit up straight like the Buddha. Kind of weird to say. You've kind of become the Buddha. You feel this energy, this stability, this confidence. So we can feel confident that we're at our job, we have our opinion, we share our opinion. We're confident. Then we're open to adjusting our opinion, but so confidence is good, that it's different from arrogance. And likewise, humbleness is good, but humbleness doesn't mean low self-esteem. Humbleness means, so I find, I'll be having conversations with people and they'll like, oh, I have some experience with that. Kind of terrible to watch me do that. It's like watching a car wreck or something. It's like, well, let me tell you about my experience. Enough about you. What about me? And then I have to like coach myself, like, okay, it's not always about me, but let's ask them a question about furthering their experience instead of feeling I need to tell them about my experience. A very practical side. Managing this. But we'll never get rid of ego. Catechary Roshi said, use your ego to help people. I got my ideas, I got my confidence, and how can I help? That answer your question?
Like you want.
Oh my gosh, it was pretty special for me because I was only 21 years old, and I kind of a hippie rejecting Western civilization, whatever that means. So I didn't have role models, and I just saw him in his robes, and I was like, oh my God, this is. So for me, he was kind of like my father figure because I was so young. But what I say about him, I say, I never met anybody more serious. He'd have this, he'd get this kind of stern but relaxed look, like he'd just shoot you a glance. And he offered this crazy schedule where he meditated 5 in the morning, 6 days a week, which I could do in my 20s and 30s. Just incredible dedication. And at the same time, I've never met anybody less serious. So this isn't making sense. How can somebody be the most serious person I've ever met and the least serious person I've ever met? But he would just like light up like a light bulb and laugh, and I called him a sit-down comedian. His Dharma talks were so funny, and he was so he'd be serious, but then it'd be over, and he'd be. I was sitting on a bench with him outside. They had spaghetti, and he looks. Oh, look! I spilled spaghetti sauce all over my white robe, ha ha ha. No, it's just like pretty unattached. That's all I'm going to say. Got more questions, come back next week and ask somebody else.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.